I, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, dedicate this day of Sunday to America, firm and free.
If you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I am a minute man. I am the guardian of America, armed and free. For we knew it will always be the citizen who is the guardian of America, armed and free.
Welcome to America Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
Indeed, we are the guardians of America, armed and free. Both uniform and civilians like me. Lieutenant General Robin Rand is the commander, 12th Air Force, Air Combat Command commander, and Air Force's Southern United States Southern Command, located here at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. It is a joy, a privilege, and an honor to welcome you to the microphones and telephones of America Armed and Free, General Rand.
Thank you, Charles. It's good to be here.
My pleasure. What originally interested you in being in the Air Force?
Well, I kind of was raised up in the Air Force. My father was a professional officer in the United States Air Force, and so certainly from an early age, being around him and being basically born and raised into the Air Force, I'm sure that played quite a bit.
That had a lot to do with it. Was he administrative or was he a pilot?
No, he was a pilot. I'm real proud of my dad. He passed away a little over a year ago, but he was a young man who, at the outbreak of World War II, joined the Army Air Corps back then and served in the South Pacific and was a combat veteran there and continued to serve for the next 33 years. He retired in 1974, the year that I graduated from high school. My dad retired.
So. Be darned. Fighters? Bombers?
He flew fighters, and he served in combat both in World War II and another tour in Vietnam. So
interesting.
Very, very proud of him. And obviously, I wasn't sure that I was that interested in an Air Force career, but my senior year, I remember going to him and saying, Dad, if someone was interested in going to the Air Force Academy, you know, is it too late? I was already a senior. And he said, well, why are you asking? I go, I was just kind of curious, and the rest is history. And so
be done.
I elected to go down that road, and here I am.
So I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you. It was a life well lived, so yeah. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. Counting the Air Force Academy, you've been in the Air Force since about 1975, I think.
Just about right.
Yeah,
I actually
76.
I came in the summer of 1974. I went to the Air Force Academy prep school. You enlist, and it's just that. I needed a little help academically to spin up, and so I went to the prep school for a year, and then I started the summer of 1975 at the Air Force Academy.
It's one thing to serve your country, but it's another thing altogether to give 36 years, in essence, all of your adult life since you've been 18 to it. Why do you serve?
Wow, that's a great question, Charles. I appreciate the opportunity to answer it. It's probably expanded some over time, but it's real simple in my mind now. I'm fond of saying three main reasons. The mission, I very much passionately believe in what we're doing in the Air Force. I continue to serve for the airmen that are performing the mission. And then the third reason is the families who support those airmen. So those are the three things for me. Mission, airmen, families is what it's kind of crystallized and kind of collectively come down to.
Sounds a lot like duty, honor, country.
Well, I think you're right. It does sound a lot like that, doesn't it?
Does it?
Well, I'll tell you, the mission's important, and then you're around these these fine young men and women, and I get a lot of strength from them. They don't even realize it, but what we ask them to do is amazing, and the families who support them are equally amazing, and so it's easy. It's easy to keep serving.
I think that I got it. It's easy for you. I think they do get how much love isn't the right word, but it effectively is what it is. But I think they do get how much attention, how much focus you have on serving them, because I see it in the way people around. I've gotten to interact with two members of your staff, and they could not be happier to be working for you and working in the Air Force. I can tell that by their attitude. They've never said a word to me about it, but I can tell that they want to be here. How is it you engender that? Obviously, you can't give them any extra money. You can't give them any extra stuff. How is it you engender that attitude in the troops that you lead?
Well, first of all, that's very kind of you to say that, so thank you.
Pardon me on interruption. It's strictly based on observation,
right.
Not on any desire to flatter or anything else. I'm just telling you what I see.
And I do. I appreciate that. I think I like to take a page out of my wife's book. There's a lot of things that you can say and do about leadership. Books have been written. We could spend the next 2 weeks talking about leadership traits and characteristics, and I think it's important to always reflect on leading and the fundamentals that go with it. And the good news is leadership is something that you can teach and something you can learn. It's not just for those who are born natural leaders. We can develop our leadership skills. I firmly believe that. But one thing my wife has told me and has told others when people will ask her, and she says, at the end of the day, just be kind. And I think what airmen want, what all of us want, is to be treated with kindness professionally and validate what they do. Let them know that what they do is important. And you're right. You can't pay them more, and there's a lot of things we can't do for them, but you can certainly tell them sincerely thank you and recognize them when it's appropriate.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to do. I don't know if I'm always successful. I'm sure there are times I'm not, but I certainly attempt to be that way.
You know, there's no economic or little economic value in a ribbon or a commendation. You can't, you know, they do it on, it's an honor-based culture. And, you know, I'm amazed. I got to go to sea on the USS Tucson about a year ago. I'm just completely amazed. I mean, I know what to expect, but I'm completely amazed not only by people in the Navy, but especially the submarine community. That's a very special commitment.
Amen. I agree.
And, you know, to that, and I'm floored by the one guy was an engineer at Ford. He was 30, and he was going to miss out on the opportunity to serve. He put his car in storage. He put his belongings in storage, and he joined the Navy as an E-1. And I'm just, you know, I see this throughout the military community. It's certainly not limited to the Navy or the submariners, and it's just stunning to see that there are people like that. You know, that we grow them. I mean, you know, that's what we grow here. Speaking of the people and supporting them, tell us about the mission of the 12th Air Force. What do you do?
Oh, that's great. It's a really phenomenal job. There's two parts to it. There's the 12th Air Force piece that I'll talk about. The title is 12th Air Force and Air Force Southern Command. And they're two distinct roles, if you will, with one headquarters. And so I'm the 12th Air Force Commander in the Air Force Southern Command, which is the component to Southcom, which is headquartered in Miami. 12th Air Force first. is comprised of 10 wings, so 10 different locations, in one Red Horse squadron, which is a big civil engineer squadron, and in 12th Air Force. Plus, we have 19 units that are aligned to us that are Guard, Air National Guard, and Air Force Reserve Command. So when you add all that up, there's close to 70,000 people, airmen, close to 700 airplanes. I think we have, I should know this, Cole, but 18 different types of aircraft that are assigned to 12th Air Force. And the men and women at 12th Air Force, that comprise that are the ones that will go and do whatever our nation needs them to do, whether it's over in the Central Command, the Middle East area of responsibility, whether it's in the Far East and Korea, whether it's down in the, you know, Central and South America. So great airmen doing great things spread around the country. And my role as 12th Air Force Commander is we call it organized, train, and equip. We just make sure that those men and women are able to do their combat mission when directed. Then you have the AFSouth role. And as the Air Force component to SOUTHCOM, Southern Command, my job is to work with the Air Forces in Central and South America. And that's what we do. And we have three roles that we're primarily focused on, three priorities there is the counter transnational organized crime, which mostly is concentrating right now on illicit drug trafficking. We're there to help with humanitarian assistance / disaster relief. Remember the terrible earthquake in Haiti. And then to build partnership capacity, to continue to build these relationships with the Western Hemisphere countries that are in our backyard. And so that's the other part of the job I have.
Admiral Mike Mullen, when he was Chief of Naval Operations, before they kicked him upstairs to be the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs,
right,
had a concept that I read about in Proceedings magazine. I take Proceedings, and I'm sorry I don't read the Air Force Journal. Anyway, but the Proceedings had this long article by him called The Thousand Ship Navy. And the Thousand Ship Navy, of course, we only have 287 ships, but you got them with a Navy way beat in numbers, but just in the 12th Air Force alone. But the concept was combining navies of other countries and working with them in tandem to create, in effect, the Thousand Ship Navy. Does the Air Force have any concept like that in the way it partners with people in the Southern Command, or is that possible because we have such advanced technology that they don't have?
No, that's a wonderful question. And what we're trying to do with these air forces and their army and their navies is to help them help themselves. And a lot of what we do isn't to give them things as much as it is to work with them and to share our tactics, our training, and some of the procedures that we have. And it's not all give and take. We learn as well from them, and we are partnering together to be able to assist. And you bet, it's not just the United States. If there was a situation that happened again, I'll go back to Haiti because that's the most recent. Many of the countries in Central and South America have been providing assistance and help.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, because as Americans, we are so used to having everything so plentiful here, and then we go to a country like Haiti, which, you know, the houses are sometimes just cardboard if they're lucky enough to have a house.
Absolutely.
And we forget that, you know, we can't just, you know, they can't just pull out their iPhone and look something up or maybe access GPS for navigation or go to the airport and go to Enterprise and rent a car. Do you learn from them how to work with countries that don't have anywhere near the amount of things that we do? I mean, can they?
Absolutely.
We
absolutely learn from them, and they learn from us. And it is about managing expectations and just being realistic. And it's not all the shiny high tech things that we need. And that's not what a lot of these countries need anyway. So.
Mm-hmm. They don't need an F-22, they need clean water.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well said.
Stand by.
This is Aaron Simpson. You're listening to America Armed and Free. There are 45 good reasons to listen to America Armed and Free with Charles Heller.
What do 40 years of experience in talk radio bring you? Find out when radio legend Barry Farber joins Charles Heller at noon Sunday, July 1st, on Liberty Watch about his new book, Cocktails with Molotov, at 1 p.m. The latest on things with a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade on America Armed and Free. Liberty Watch and America Armed and Free. Sundays, noon to 2, right after Swap Shop.
I just have to say it. At ease, folks. we have, if you just joined us, we have the joy, the pleasure, and the honor of having with us General Robin Rand. For a second, I was going to stumble and say General Robin Olds. He's no longer with us, but you do share a common first name with a famous general. Did you know General Olds? Whoops, let's try that again. Sorry, go ahead.
I did know him, Charles. Wonderful man. Absolutely wonderful.
He pioneered a lot of different things about communications and tactics in Vietnam. Do we still... Is the Air Force good at remembering its lessons?
I'm pondering that question. That's an area that we always have to work at. I think we are, though. I think
can you
certainly
give me-
at the tactical level, there are times probably at the operational and strategic level where I think just in general we could improve more. But tactically, we work very, very hard at incorporating our lessons.
Could you give an example of a lesson that you think we learned from that we learned in Vietnam about our tactics, or that we've learned since then, that we learned in, from previous campaigns that we've applied to Air Force tactics now? Like, I remember, for instance, I remember in the briefing you gave at the Air Force Association, you talk about a pilot who actually flew, I think, got target fixation and flew into his target.
Right.
And that's something we've known since at least pre-World War, or at least World War II times, and yet it still happened to somebody. Maybe you can explain that circumstance and talk a little bit about how we applied our lessons.
The lessons, what we do is we realize that, I'll give you an example. You asked how we have applied lessons. I think as we went into Desert Storm in 1990, Desert Shield, and then in the Desert Storm in 1990 and then early 1991, we weren't nearly as good at applying ourselves at night. We weren't at nearly the precision-guided munitions-capable Air Force that we became. And what we realized from that war was that owning the night was a good thing to do, and being able to apply precision-guided munitions are so much more effective. And we rapidly applied those lessons learned and had the opportunity in Kosovo several years later to apply that. And then, again, when we went and did OEF, the early stages of Afghanistan, and certainly when OIF started in March of 2003 in Iraq, very, very successful campaigns, air campaigns, where we applied the lessons that we had learned from Vietnam, from Desert Storm, and I think really set us on our way.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a little different environment now. Once we got control of the skies and we're able to do that part of it, we've been supporting the Army, the Marines, you know, the ground forces, and we have applied a lot of the same lessons that we learned in Vietnam about being able to do that.
About close air support.
Close air support,
right.
Absolutely.
Well, are you referring in part also to the upgrading that's been done to the A-10 to make it night fighter capable?
Absolutely.
There's been a tremendous upgrade program because the Air Force was going to get rid of it, and then they decided not to.
We've upgraded the airplanes, the new avionic packages, and just so much more capability. But a lot of the basic lessons of close air support are still applied And so we apply those lessons, and we're always trying to glean from what we do in training and previous conflicts.
All right, we're going to go to the phones,
okay.
And we have caller Kevin. Kevin, you are live on America Armed and Free with General Rand, with Lieutenant General Rand. Your comment or question for him?
Well, my question is, I want it to be clear as a longtime Tucsonan about the role of Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, in that, I've been worried about the fighter that they're trying to bring to the Air Guard and all of that, and everybody's fighting over the noise and stuff. The way I see Davis-Monthan is that it's the repository and the storage base for all of our basically like reserve Air Force. If we ever get into a big one with China or a major power, and our first line fighters and things are being hammered by capable pilots with aircraft that are similar to ours, we'll need all of these planes that are out here, the hundreds and maybe thousands of them that are out here, and need pilots to get into them to be able to fight a prolonged war of that type. Plus, we've got the Army command of communications at Fort Huachuca right down here. And
the signals command.
Yeah, the Central Command, and Davis Monton's right on the border. We're like a frontier fort here on the border of Mexico. And I want to see operational tactical fighters there to defend all of that assets that we have here, because it's going to be of extreme value to our country. Is that kind of put it in a nutshell, or is there some other idea about Davis Monton?
Stand by. I want to hear General Rand's full answer to this one.
Well, thanks for the question. I think Davis Monthan is a premier base in our Air Force, and there are no ongoing discussions to change that. I'm a tenant unit on Davis Monthan. 12th Air Force is a tenant. The host unit is the 355th Fighter Wing, and it flies the A-10s, does a tremendous mission for our country and for our Air Force. It also hosts a rescue group of HH-60 helicopters, and it's also host EC-130 group that's a part of the 55th wing that's actually assigned at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha. So there are no ongoing changes, and you mentioned about all the – we affectionately call it the Boneyard, AMARC, where we have all the airplanes. So Davis Monthan is in very, very important to our country and to our Air Force, and performs just a huge role. So the other reason that it's such a good location, as you mentioned too, is we have the luxury of being able to have easy access to the Barry M. Goldwater Range complex, which is such a wonderful national asset for training and for certainly our combat training. And then last but not least, being here at Tucson is the phenomenal flying weather that affords the pilots who fly here. So a lot of good reasons for us from a tactical point on why we like operating out of Davis Monthan.
Kevin, do you have a quick follow-up or no?
Well, yeah, I have a question because, we're so close to the border, and there's been all of this political brouhaha about protecting the border and all of this kind of stuff, and I've always thought that if there was any target in the United States that would be worth getting after by some terrorist that could bring in a dirty bomb or bring in something that would get them on the map, so to speak, Tucson would be a prime target. Because of the Boneyard and that stuff that's there, they could damage us severely.
It's not as much the Boneyard as it is. It's not as much the Boneyard, I bet, as it is Raytheon.
Well, whichever it is, I would expect that the United States military, both the Army and the Air Force down here, because we are like Fort Apache. We have a country.
I was thinking we're more like Fort Lowell, but okay.
Yeah, Fort Lowell. Come on. Anyway, I would like to see this. Tremendous strength at this base to be able to protect itself and us and our country.
Take your answer on the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kevin, I'm not sure the question you're asking.
Well, okay, Kevin, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, can you refine it real quick before the break? What is it you'd like to see?
Well, I'd like to see that Davis Monthan is going to stay there as and is protected well by, security forces and whatnot, so that nobody can get to those reserve airplanes that we have there.
I can tell you this, Kevin, and I know the general probably cannot speak about it. There's an awful lot of security at DM you do not see, and there's stuff. There's electronic stuff. They know if somebody's near a fence. They know, they can tell kind of how many somebody's are near a fence, and that's all I'm going to say about it because I know I know some things about it. I can tell you that the base is pretty well protected, but you might want to expand on it.
No, I think, Charles, that's good. We're protected. Our force protection is very, very high on our priority at all our military installations. no more or no less, and Davis Mothins in very good situation that comes to that.
This is a friendly interview. Nobody gets a free pass. Why in the world do you restrict responsible, maybe more senior NCOs, people who have demonstrated long amounts of maturity? Why in God's name do you restrict these people who maybe have a concealed weapons permit from carrying the means of personal protection or stopping a Nidal Hassan like happened at Fort Hood? Why does the Air Force and the Army do that?
You know, I don't have an answer for you because I haven't thought through it, but I will come back to you with an answer. You ask me the question and I'll come back to you.
I mean, I realize there's a political component to it you may not want to address, but in your experience, you're a three-star general. In your experience, you're trusting some of these people with handling nuclear stuff. Can we not trust them with an M9 under their uniform, under their camo uniform, so that, God forbid, we have another attempted massacre by a jihadist, we can stop them in their tracks? Is there any reason why we shouldn't?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of lack of trust, Charles. We do trust our senior NCOs. We trust our young airmen. We trust all the people. A fundamental of what we do is absolutely built on trust. So it's not an issue of trust.
What stops that from happening? Or is it something you can't
talk about?
I
honestly, to give you an answer now, I think I'd be just
got
kind
it.
Of pulling it out of the air. So I'll come back to
I'll
you.
Table the question.
Okay, very good.
And
fair enough.
As the music comes up on...
What do 40 years of experience in talk radio bring you? Find out when radio legend Barry Farber joins Charles Heller at noon Sunday, July 1st, on Liberty Watch about his new book, Cocktails with Molotov. At 1 p.m., the latest on things with a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade on America Armed and Free. Liberty Watch and America Armed and Free. Sundays, noon to 2, right after Swap Shop.
This is Aaron Simpson. You're listening to America Armed and Free. There are 45 good reasons to listen to America Armed and Free with Charles Heller.
Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of. Wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while, with silent, lifting mind, I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. Welcome back to America Armed and Free, where we have the joy, the pleasure, and the special honor of having with us Lieutenant General Robin Rand live in studio. That was written in 1941 by Flight Officer, his last name is McGee, I think it was Richard Gillespie McGee, and who was 21 years old, or excuse me, he was 19 years old when he wrote it. He did not reach his 20th birthday. He was killed coming out at about 1,400 feet AGL, coming out of the clouds, and in a training accident. He had a mid-air collision, tried to get out, could not get the canopy open in time, and met his fate. Do you believe that people today, and by the way, Gillespie was an American who served with the America wasn't in the war yet. He wanted to get in it. His mother was a Brit. He volunteered for the Royal Canadian Air Force, and he was an American serving in the Royal Canadian Air Force, fighting in England as a fighter pilot. Do you think that people today in the Air Force know who he was?
I do. I High Flight is a wonderful poem, and they might not know if you just put that name out. They might not initially know, but if you connected it with, have you heard the poem High Flight? And I think a lot of people could be able to identify that. But the poem is very popular still, and it struck a chord with me. That was my pop loved High Flight. He loved it, and it really is a beautiful and kind of captures how a lot of us who have firsthand experience in aviation feel about it.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You've flown the most of your career has been flying the F-16. It's amazing to once you reach flag rank to still be in the seat. There can't be very many billets in the Air Force or any other armed service where a fellow with stars on his boards can actually still be in a flying billet, are there?
No, there are not very many. Just a handful of us that are in command positions get to fly still, and because 12th Air Force is a flying command, and all the wings, the assigned 10 wings I told you are flying wings, there is some value in to me still flying. And as a matter of fact, I'll leave tomorrow to go up to Hill Air Force Base in Ogden, Utah, and I'll fly Tuesday and Wednesday and get a few F-16 missions under my belt. So I still try to keep some degree of currency and get up about every 4 or 5 weeks and fly a few sorties.
Well, if you're going to ask your people to do it, you have to be able to do it.
Absolutely. I certainly believe that's part of it. And the other reason is as we firsthand experience, I think, gives the degree of credibility and advocacy for some of the things that we need and where some of the improvements are. And so I can advocate appropriately to my superiors because I still have some opportunities to do that. So
you can be the union steward that's in management?
I think it helps, to be honest with you, and just to stay relevant to some degree. I don't need to be the ace of the base by any means. So
does it still offer, silly question, but does it still offer the same thrill when you put the throttle for, well, when you put the throttle to full military power before the detent for the for burner, does it still give you that same thrill that it did the first time you got in it?
It does. Flying is a real privilege. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to do that, and I certainly have a lot of love and passion for it. I will tell you, at this stage in my career, I'm working harder now than I probably have
really
in the past because, again, I don't get to do it as frequently. And so I can't take it lightly, and I'll study today, and I'll study tomorrow, and I'll actually go do a simulator on Monday afternoon when I get in and as I say, throw some switches and get some of the basic proficiency back a little bit. But
Block 80 or Block 62?
They fly at Hill, they fly the Block 40, it's called.
Oh, that's an older.
But to answer your question succinctly, yes, it's still a thrill. It's a real thrill to be able to fly.
Yeah. Being a fighter pilot is kind of a young man's game.
I didn't appreciate that until I took a couple of years off, and I've come back and realized that I'm working hard.
Yeah. Again, this program isn't emotions based at all. It's about facts. But I got to ask you something. There are 3 stars on your collar. Do the weight of them ever lay hard upon you?
Well, I appreciate the sentiment that the question is asked in. There are times that this is a business that is personal, at least to me it is. And so you can't do this job without it at times weighing to some degree on you. But it's not because of the stars. It's just because the connection and this is a tough business, and sometimes bad things happen to good people. And for that, you always, you identify with what other airmen are going through, their families are going through. When we have some of the tragedies that befall, so that part of it is difficult. But that doesn't just apply to me. That goes down to our youngest ranks as well. So,
okay,
I don't feel overly pressured or burdened by the job, though. I've got so many wonderful people working that are so capable and that they are so professional that in many ways, my job's pretty easy. I'll be honest with you. You know, there's so many people doing such great work. I probably have it easier than they do. So,
but you have a burden of responsibility that, well, I mean, they do. They have everybody who's volunteered to be, and it's all volunteer service, who's volunteered to be in the service has written a blank check to the government that says up to and including my, the price of my life if necessary. So none of them has a lesser burden than that, but you have a greater burden because you're the one that's responsible.
I guess, Charles, what I would say is that the good so far outweighs any of the bad, and that so all the other positives are so much more, you know, on the balance of life that you know you're able to appreciate that so much more. So
got it. I wasn't trying to be depressing.
No, it's quite all right. It's a legitimate question.
Yeah, Richard, you're live on America Armed and Free with General Robin Rand. Your comment or question for him?
Yeah, hi, Charles. Thank you for coming on, General. It's very good to get out to our local public.
Truly,
I spent 40 years in the Air Force, active Guard and Reserve. Went in 65 and retired in 2005.
Well, thank you for your service, Richard. That's impressive.
Well, we went away. I served under General Corley when he was Wing Commander, and it was kind of funny when I was giving him a little bibliography, and I told him I served under Robin Olds and Chappie James, and he came back to me and said, oh, he was a commandant of cadets when I was in the academy.
He was. That's
yeah,
exactly right.
Quite a guy. You know, the Block 40s, I've worked on, I thought 100s, 105s, and F-4s in tech school. I deployed originally to Thailand in 66 with F-4Ds, first ones with the gun pods, and I worked on A-7s and F-16s at the Guard. And the Guard here locally is flying, of course, Block 60s, and you're still flying Block 40s up at Hill. And I wanted to kind of answer a question for that guy who called. The sad fact of the matter is there's so many hours on all of our airframes that when we put something in the A-mark, basically you can't take it out if you want to.
Yeah, that's...
They've pretty much done the game.
You mean if you fly a De Havilland Comet for too many hours, you'll flex the wings so long they'll fall off?
They had that happen on the A-7s.
Really?
Well, they were still flying with the Arizona. Arizona got rid of them. New Mexico got them, and a guy did a maneuver, and his wing came off in flight. Got out okay, but wing came off.
Yeah.
No,
he got a Martin Baker tie, huh?
Well, the general will tell you that all the aircraft we have flying basically are about double what their original life expectancy was when they were put into service.
Yeah, when the B-52 comes out of service, it'll be older than the SPAD, the World War One SPAD is now.
I believe the last one was made in 65.
Wow.
Richard, I did want to clarify for everyone that the and I'm not an expert on the Guard here at Tucson, but the Block 60s they fly are largely because the UAE purchased Block 60s. We don't have any Block 60s in the active duty Air Force or any other Guard or Reserve unit. And Tucson Guard is trains for foreign military sales, FMS, and that's what they do a lot of the training is our international partners who fly the F-16. And the UAE, to the best of my knowledge, is the only country that has Block 60s. The most common F-16s that are out there are the Block 40s and Block 50s that are, and then we still are flying the Block 30s in some of our Guard and Air Force Reserve squadrons. So,
all right, thank you for your service,
and
Richard.
And again, thank you, Richard.
Thank you, General.
Thank you for your service, Richard.
We're going to go back to the phones and Mark. You are live on America Armed and Free with General Robin Rand.
Hey, General. I was in from 72 to 92 here, and one of the questions I had, you perked my interest when you said, you know, we found it interesting to control the night, and you flew F-16. So have you ever flown the Lantern system?
Well, first of all, good afternoon, Mark. And, yes, I have. I was... a squadron commander of the 36th Fabulous Flying Fiends in Osan Air Base, Korea. And we were in the mid-90s, Lantern was a big part of our mission. So I have a fair amount of time at night with the Lantern at lower altitudes. Very interesting.
Well, I was the Lantern systems engineer at Wright-Patterson. So
you did a good job, so thank you.
I was going to say, any praise we'll take, any complaints, we deserve them. So.
Well, it was great, and thank you.
Explain what Lantern does, if you would, please.
Sure. It two parts. Lantern had a terrain following feature that you were able to go down at low altitude, much lower than you would have been comfortable otherwise, and be able to fly at low at night. And then the other thing it did is, before we really became proficient with night vision goggles, it gave you some capability, at least looking out the front part of the cockpit, where you could, in a very basic description, take night and give you a little more capability to actually see. It would lighten up what was out in front of you. And so that's what the Lantern provided you the ability to do. If you turned your head to the side and you weren't looking right out the cockpit, it was backed into looking into the dark, sky. But as long as what was in your, what we call our HUD, the heads up display, you had the ability to, that now that has become less required, because now everyone is flying with fairly advanced night vision goggles.
Gen 5?
Mostly.
Gen 5 night vision goggles.
Which has given us a huge capability.
My understanding is that in Gen 6, when an ant walks across your pathway, you'll be able to determine its sex.
Well, that's pretty capable then, isn't it?
Stand by. On AM 1030 KVOI Cortero, the voice, AM 930 KAPR Douglas.
I'm Dr. Larry Wheeler, who treats patients across the state who have a lot of fear going to the dentist. Fear of dental visits is natural, and we understand your fear. Our patients typically haven't been to the dentist for 3 to 15 years. We sedate them to their optimal level of comfort. In fact, our patients routinely sleep through parts of their procedures as we correct years of painful and embarrassing problems with their teeth, sometimes in only one visit. I promise that we can do all this in ways that you never believed were possible, with no embarrassing lectures. You wouldn't think of having your tonsils or appendix removed without being sedated. Why should dentistry be any different? Call us today for a free consultation at Artistic Dentistry, 745-0030, or smilesaz.com. That's 745-0030, smilesaz.com, 745-0030.
Jeannie, my car won't start.
Oh, Master, I'm so sorry. I thought we were going to the park for a picnic.
Ah, well, Jeannie, I'm sorry, but Roger and I have to meet with Dr. Bellows to redo the spaceflight tests.
But, Master, you promised.
Now, Jeannie, don't be a brat. Please do that thing you do and make my car run again.
Oh, Master, even I can't do that. Here, call Perfection Auto Works at 323-8650. They will get you back on the road with no magic, just real old-fashioned service.
Jeannie.
I'm sorry, Master, but here's the phone.
We at Perfection Auto Works can't magically grant your auto repair wishes, but we can fix your car or truck correctly, reasonably, and quickly. Call 323-8650 or perfectionautoworks.com.
Oh, Master, I'm so glad you took your car to Perfection Auto Works.
Law Review Radio is a call-in program featuring legal topic experts, celebrities, and your questions. Hosted by Ron Zack, a Tucson attorney focusing on estate planning and elder law, but eager to venture into any legal or entertainment topic, and maybe some illegal ones. Law Review Radio, Sunday 2 to 3 on KBOI.
What do 40 years of experience in talk radio bring you? Find out when radio legend Barry Farber joins Charles Heller at noon Sunday, July 1st, on Liberty Watch about his new book, Cocktails with Molotov. At 1 p.m., the latest on things with a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade on America Armed and Free. Liberty Watch and America Armed and Free. Sundays, noon to 2, right after Swap Shop.
Little bit of Air Force Blue for you for the last segment with General Rand, General Robin Rand. And I want to ask one quick question, and I want to ask you about that wolf pack that we were discussing off the air. But is there a mission that you have flown which stands out most in your mind, General Rand?
Oh, wow. That's a wonderful question.
You got 5,000 hours.
Okay, I'll tell you one. I'll tell you there's a mission that I didn't fly, that stands out the most in my mind. How's that sound? It was the mission that I was taxiing for takeoff, and I got the call, and this was in November of 2006 in combat, and they said, the squadron op said, we need you to accelerate takeoff as quickly as you can. We have a CSAR, combat search and rescue, underway. And it didn't dawn on me, which meant that someone had gone down. That the second that, you know, knowing that all the Air Force in Iraq at that time was part of the wing I commanded, 332nd. And so I said, Roger, let's hustle. And then within about a minute or two, they called me back and said, disregard accelerating your takeoff. We need you to shut down and come back into the squadron. And that's when I didn't argue with them, and I came back in, and as I knew walking in that I was going to be informed that it was one of our airplanes, one of our pilots. And so that resonates with me because as it turned out, the pilot who went down and was killed that day had been my executive officer at Luke Air Force Base about 4 months prior to that. And so I remember that like it was yesterday. So that's the mission I didn't fly that sticks out the most. But I've had thousands, literally with 5,000 hours of flying time, I've had thousands of missions. So it's hard to pick one.
Mm-hmm. If you could meet any figure in history in aviation, who would it be?
Oh, my gosh. That's a great question. I was at the Holloman Air Force Base, the 49th Wing in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and one of the leading ace of World War II was an individual named Richard Bong, and Richard Bong flew with the 49th Fighter Group at that time. And so when you walk into the headquarters today, they have a tribute to Richard Bong, and just reading that, I would love to have been able to meet and talk with someone like that. We've already mentioned General Olds and what a character he was, and what a spectacular leader in our Air Force he was. And I've had the opportunity to meet him, and then the Billy Mitchells and the Curtis LeMays. And
LeMay only died in 1995.
I recently read his book that came out here in the last couple of years, fascinating read.
And I had the author on, yeah.
So, I mean, there's too many of the name. I'd love to meet a lot of those fellows, because what they did was incredible.
Do you know there was a fellow by the name of Reverend Wright who is famous for coining the phrase, if man was meant to fly, he'd have wings?
That's interesting, isn't it?
Do you know who his sons were?
No.
Wilbur and Orville.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, now that makes sense. Sure.
So, how did the Wolfpack get its name,
okay,
with General
Wolves? I know we're coming up close.
Yeah, we got
time.
About 2 minutes.
The 8th Fighter Wing is stationed in Kunsan Air Base, Korea, and I know many of your listeners in the Air Force have probably served there, but it's a historic wing that flew in World War II, and it was the 8th Fighter Wing. But in 1966, the 8th Fighter Wing was assigned to Thailand and was commanded by then Colonel Robin Olson. He was the commander, and he did a mission that he helped devise. It was called Operation Bolo. And as he was leading that mission, he had all his pilots that were going to fly that day, and he stood up there, and as he was finishing his brief, he said, "All right, men, let's be like a bunch of wolves, go get them wolf pack." And that stuck. And from that day forth, the 8th Fighter Wing has been called the Wolfpack, and the commander, and it changes over every year because it's without families at Kunsan, the commander is affectionately called the Wolf. And all the airmen, the youngest to the oldest, refer to the wing commander as the Wolf, and it's truly a term of endearment. And so that's how it happened in 2003. I was the commander of the Wolfpack, and we brought Robin Olds over and were able to spend about 4 days with him. It was a wonderful visit.
Hard living, huh?
It was a wonderful visit.
There's talk about the weather for a second. A person is 18, and they're looking at their career in front of them, and they look at you and say, "General Olds, what would you tell me if I wanted to be in the Air Force?"
I would tell them that we would welcome their service if they were interested in again, our core values of service, integrity, and excellence, and they're committed to that we have a place for them.
How do we teach? How do we get? Because part of when you get to where you are, you communicate with people. The Air Force trusts you to come on the radio and speak with honor and grace for the service. How do we communicate to the world, to the civilian population of the United States, the bond of honor that being in the military is? How do we communicate that to people? A very small percentage of our population is in the military. How do we communicate with them about honor and about service? 40 seconds.
Okay. The way I would suggest that we communicate best is we let people know that we have standards in the military, and that the maintenance and the compliance of those standards is everything. And when you don't adhere to the standards, there are consequences. And we aren't perfect, and we have people that will make mistakes, but there's accountability. And that's what I would convey to people, is that we adhere to our standards, and we enforce those standards.
General Rand, it has been a truly a privilege to have you, and I'm so glad that you take some of your Sunday to put the uniform back on a Sunday and come down here.
Oh, you're welcome, Charles.
And to inform the audience of just the importance of what it is the Air Force does. I truly appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. I want to encourage everyone to be vigorous, not violent, vigilant, not vituperative, in liberty, and with the great honor that it is to sit not only across from General Rand, but from his staff, people who care about this country and who make sure that the 3-star looks good in what he does, not to make him look good, but so that he can lead people serving this country. That is a commitment that must be appreciated by all who listen. In Liberty, I'm Charles Heller.